So what does it, for you, having written, I guess, undoubtedly the first commercially, wildly commercially successful word processing program on microcomputers, right? That would be WordStar.
The most successful one coming out of the sort of hobbyist
The
community,
hobbyist
hobbyist
community
hacker
with the
community, and
CPM,
going to their computers.
lineage,
Yeah,
right?
it wasn't quite hobbyist priced, but
Right, what was it priced on?
$4.95.
So
I mean,
it was like
same or
Microsoft's first 4K basic or 8K basic on Altair was like $400 and some.
it was okay.
Yeah. And then people copied the paper tapes, of course.
Yeah, one person bought it and took it to the Homebrew Computer Club.
So what does it feel like to you sitting and using Microsoft Word and things like that and thinking back?
Yeah, well, I mean, I got into it largely because I needed to write manuals for software I was writing. And so I was a user of word processing, so it was
Gotcha.
something I did fairly well.
So you wrote it as a.
And I understood it from the user point of view and could.
You wrote it as a tool for you initially. And you wrote it to
Pretty much.
8080 assembler
Yeah, I
and
should say yes and no on that. Because I wrote it, I was familiar with using runoff programs.
Gotcha.
And
Like
using a text
TROP and.
editor and a runoff. Well, the first one I had was called runoff. That was a BBM in the 60s.
So
And yeah, TROP, I think, is what the one in the 8080 was called.
were they line editors or were they screen editors?
The runoff program was a batch, though.
It was
You used an
batch.
editor separately. It made a text file. And then the
Gotcha.
runoff program formatted and paginated it.
Because you know on the link under LAP 6, which was their op they actually had a full I had a screen editor with cursors you went and edited, right? Full screen editor 1963, 64.
Yeah, but when you insert a
Amazing.
word in a line, how do you realign the rest of the paragraph?
I think it scrolled. I think
I
it flowed.
think for programs generally, you didn't need to do that.
Right, but this was used to
Yeah,
write
because there was
papers
no.
and in fact that the same
Okay.
environment wrote papers and programs. So it was called a they were called manuscripts, but it could be a paper or a program, or it was all
Okay.
the same thing really. But for me, I was always fascinated because I started off on the PDP 11, and on a later PDP machine we had Emacs. And I just loved Emacs, but Emacs took so much CPU. It was so that they told the students that they couldn't use it anymore. So I wrote a little Emacs for me because I love screen editing, and I worked out how to do the buffers in one long string maybe or something else of how to insert and delete characters and make it work. And so I could kind of in my head imagine what it was like for you creating
Not very
WordStar.
conceptually difficult. Well, the machine wasn't fast enough to reformat on the fly, so you had to use a command to realign your paragraph after you made a change.
Gotcha.
But what I did as a program editor didn't do any word wrap. The line would just get longer and go off the screen.
Gotcha.
Or it would wrap on the screen, but it would not be, but the wraps wouldn't be stored in the file. And it was Samer's idea that you could sell a word processor with word wrap in it.
Okay.
So I put word wrap into the text editor code I had, and then kept fiddling and adding. And I think it was me that realized you need a print function, kind of as a separate function, because the way you format it for the screen isn't quite the same as the way you format it for the printer.
So
Back when, because the screens were fixed to spacing, but you wanted to be able to print with a proportional spacing font,
Right,
potentially. So you
right.
had to format it again as you printed.
So you came up, in a sense, the print driver was the innovation there. Or were there like loadable print drivers for different printers?
Yeah, let's distinguish two things. One is the print function, deciding how you want the character to appear on the page and when to start a new page. And you think up some set of primitives that outputs. Then I would use the term print driver for the thing that implements that on the various printers, because those were all different. I mean, they still are. It's just for Windows, this printer-specific stuff comes in the CD you get with the printer, and you don't even know what it is anymore.
Right.
Because there was a time when people would type escape sequences into their documents to use functions in their printers that their program didn't use.
There were printer dependent
Yeah,
functions,
and
yeah.
then you didn't have a program.
So how was it? I mean, in a sense, well, WordStar, as I always remember, did its own, you know, it had its own file management window and file management functions. Did that come later on? Or did you always have like a file management interface showing the documents and pick them and delete them?
Well, let's divide file management. Part of file management is where you put it on the disk.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an operating system problem, and that's completely left in CVM.
Right.
You know, WordStar did the thing of displaying the file names on the screen. I don't think that was in the first one. I don't remember, actually. I
it
think
was
that was
seemed,
a later edition.
It would seem to me that would be in a later edition.
Yeah, I think it was it. I mean, it's not part of the core function. I mean, to me as a programmer, well, you want to open the disk, you go back to the operating system and type dir return.
And then you type.
But somebody who wasn't a programmer said that was a nuisance, and I heard them and thought about it, and yeah, why not put the files on the screen? But still, you had to retype the file name into the. You know, you press D if you want to edit a document, and it asks for the file name, and you have to type it again.
Or could you pick it using the cursor keys moving around?
I don't think I ever did that.
But you could list. You could list them.
Oh, well, by default, it would leave a list on the screen. I mean, when you weren't editing a document. You know, by version 2 anyway, it would bring up a menu and then it would fill the rest of the screen with the file names.
And down the digibar, and you were, go ahead, you were saying?
I said, the thing I liked was being able to retype your previous answer to any question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you type D to edit a document and ask for the file name. If you type Control R, the old name turns up.
Okay.
That was my solution. The Windows solution is better. The whole name turns up highlighted. And if you just start typing, it replaces it.
Right.
Well, but you didn't know you had the highlight since I was using a generic terminal. And besides,
yeah.
It didn't occur to me.
You
I wasn't as smart as all those people at Xerox put together.
Right, where they had control over every pixel and they knew what they were going to be able to do visually.
Yeah, and they had a lot more brains working on it a lot longer, too.
But, you know, it's funny. My father loved WordStar. You know, he got a Mac. He had WordStar on IBM XT, you know, WordStar for DOS, and in his brain he had coded in all the keystrokes. He didn't have to move around. At that time, he was getting older and starting to have problems. He later developed Parkinson's, and he couldn't use a mouse and click. It just was too much effort. But the command sequences that he had already coded in his brain were just fine.
Kept working.
Yeah, so for him, it was a minimal invasive, minimal energy interface to just get done what he wanted to do, which is format paragraphs and write manuscripts. And I can imagine, it was sort of, here I was as a son, a prodigal son, gone to the U.S. to build graphical interfaces on the PC. I would come home and my father would be using WordStar and saying, I don't want to use that. And it made me think at the time, I wonder if we're building out some usability by having forced people to go through this new paradigm.
I think we're building an easier learnability, which I think was the. I mean, to me, you know, it was the only program I used much. You know, when I was using a computer, I was always preparing text, and the fact that you had to memorize the commands was, you know, a small part of a long learning layer for using a computer.
Yeah.
But if you use a lot of different programs, they need to be faster to learn. And the most obvious difference is to make the commands mnemonic for the function. You know, rather than, you know, like you press a U to move the, control U to move the cursor up, perhaps, because you can remember that easily.
Right.
Whereas I thought of easy motions. You know, and spatially easy to remember, except we make the dangerous ones hard to type. And that's why line delete is control Y, because it's away from you and it's off the home keys.
Okay.
You know, it's about one of the hardest to type letters.
And of course, the whole two key sequence, like control K, control Q, quit without save, right?
That
was.
Yeah.
And you used control K because it was on every terminal or it was available everywhere.
Well, I put the cursor motion on the left hand,
so
you could type it one-handed.
Gotcha.
Because that was what you used the most besides text. You wanted to be able to move the cursor left-handed while you're returning the page in your source document or something, right-handed, or, you know, finding the disk and inserting it.
So you would
some damn things. So
hold
the other
key,
things
hold control down and do the cursor motions.
Yeah.
On those? Yeah.
Remember the control key was where the shift lock key was.
Okay. Right.
Yeah, that was it. Was very hard to learn to do that with the control key where IBM moved it.
Yes. Yeah, that's for sure.
Because the you'll see my keyboard. Because I think the keyboard that they bought put the shift lock key in the usual place and the control key down.
Mm-hmm.
And I rewrote the firmware for it so that to get the control key back where I thought it should be.
Okay.
Where it is on an ASR33.
Okay.
Where the shift lock key is on a modern keyboard. I mean, now I can type control keys, but for years I had trouble with an IBM keyboard. It really bitched me.
Right. You deserve.
Yeah. Because the other thing you get nowadays is there's a control key on available for each hand.
Right.
And I guess some people type them two-handed, but I always learned to type them one-handed.
Yeah. So you always had
that way.
You always had to write to the lowest common denominator. So 80-80.
Oh, that's it. Fantasies of selling lots of copies.
Right.
But it wasn't so much I had to write as that was the obvious thing to do.
So you were there, sitting there at IMSI, writing a program to help you write documentation.
Mm-hmm.
And then how did that convert to, and I'm sure you've been asked 100 times, but how did that convert into MicroPro and WordStar as a business?
Well, there was sort of some writing on the wall at the inside that it wasn't going to go very far very long. Actually, I thought the same thing would happen with software, and it didn't. You know, because IMSI had a lot of pretensions of being a huge, big, profitable company, and they had a big sales department and stuff, and they had a lot of overhead.
Mm-hmm.
And what had happened would be they'd put something on the market, and 6 months later, somebody would be making in their garage for half as much money. With I guess partly just less overhead, and also if they had a shorter design cycle, they'd be using a newer set of chips.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'd have a memory board design that used denser chips, and so it would be cheaper. And Bill Millard, who owned IMSI, I think, saw the writing, decided the money was in not in manufacturing, but in selling, and started Computer Land.
Gotcha.
And gossip has it any way that you get an IMSI.
Okay. And of course, he started Computerland in time for IBM to come to him to be able to sell the PC through Computerland.
I bought my first PC at Computerland.
Yeah, that's right.
$3,000 or $4,000, I think. I never paid as much for a computer again. But
So you guys could see the writing on the wall. And so who decided?
So when I didn't quite know where I was going. I just thought there were lots of options out there, and I met some people at IMSI and so on. So I bought an IMSI to have it home. And actually, that let me take it out of my payroll without pay for it over time without any particular agreement. But then 2 weeks later, I gave them 2 weeks' notice.
Oh!
And I was sort of having fun controlling things because they were a bunch of assholes. And we're a whole lot into
for the listener. Werner Erhard.
Werner Erhard,
right?
And yes, assholes. When something's over, it's over. You know, if you're going to get rid of somebody, you see them out the door in an hour, and that's that. But I was in the middle of a whole lot of things, and I actually gave them 2 weeks' notice and finished, and got to stay there and finish my things, rather than because I was doing stuff that was important enough to them, and I wanted to finish my projects and give them some time to do some planning.
So they didn't, you wrote WordStar on their time, but they didn't care about.
No, I wrote a text editor on their time. And
gotcha.
No, WordStar was, the idea for WordStar was several months in the future. The first thing I actually did was work for my brother's solar energy business in Berkeley.
Oh, okay.
For a while. I'd done some talking with Seymour Rubenstein, who was their marketing director, and he said he was interested in me.
So the text editor at IMSI was the proto WordStar, the pre WordStar project.
Well, it was a text editor. There was something similar called WordMaster that I did for MicroPro.
Okay.
MicroPro's first two products were WordMaster and SuperSort. And SuperSort was a bunch of Seymour's ideas because he knew about business computing, which I didn't. It was just a classic sort program with a zillion bells and whistles in it. It would help all kinds of different ways of comparing things. If you thought like a programmer, you could do an incredible amount of data processing with it.
Right.
but not enough people did to sell enough of them,
right.
So that you never got converted to the IBM. You know, now and then you'd meet people who say, gee, that's really super, it does so much. And, but it wasn't near enough any applications. You know, that and the IBM PC had a primitive sort.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but all you could set was the column number,
you
know, built into the command structure.
Yeah, that's about it.
Yeah, that and other Unix-like programs that you could, I guess it wasn't at first, but in a while you could pipeline them with greater than, you could do an awful lot than SuperSort would do.
I remember Unix was such a rich and command line environment, and you went to DOS, and you were like, what? They didn't do anything. There's nothing in here you can do.
I never went that way. I might have never come back.
Right. That's right. You would have been sucked into the Unix world.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it would have been.
So you and Seymour then got together, and that's how it all gelled after you worked for your brother.
What gelled was Seymour said, write a word, put word wrap in, write a word processor, and that sold.
Okay.
And Seymour thought his market was office people, small businessmen. His standard talk seemed to involve telling somebody about what she could do if you buy her this program, your secretary.
Gotcha.
But,
because
he was trying to sell a lot of them at $495 each.
So in a sense, the addition, word wrap is the dividing feature, the great divide between the text editor the programmer would use and the office person would use. And then from there on, everything flows.
I think so. Yeah, there are lots of details in that you, for a document, you may be able to want to produce effects on the printer you can't produce on the screen. You want to be able to embed graphics and lots of stuff, whereas generally when you print a program, you want to just reproduce what you see on the screen.
Right.
I mean, all the compiler sees in the program is ASCII codes, and that's all you need to be able to reproduce.
So the initial, when WordStar came out of the word wrapping, and then what was the initial launch of it? I mean,
We showed version 0.93 at some computer fair in the spring of 79,
which could have been the West Coast Computer Fair, but we don't know for sure.
I wouldn't be surprised if it's on the internet somewhere.
Yeah.
I Googled my name and I Googled WordStar, and I found an awful lot of stuff in the last few days.
Yeah, I actually did the same thing.
I found pictures of myself at a party I remember being at, but I don't remember anybody taking that picture.
I saw that too. Yes, yeah, so probably was the West Coast Computer Fair. I mean, you guys were based here in the Bay Area, and that was what the big thing of the year. Jim Warren's guy riding roller skates around. That was his trademark. The conference organizer Jim Warren rode roller skates around, and it was in the old San Francisco Civic Center Auditorium.
Yeah, something. Sounds right.
Before Moscone was built.
Yeah, for sure.
That's where it was.
But I remember also going to one outside of New York.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because we didn't have salespeople to speak of. You know, so sometimes I'd be behind the desk answering questions. And I remember, actually, let's see, this is from before WordStar. Some guy turned up who wanted to type scripts in an incredible format.
Huh.
And, you know, very specially commented format. And I said, make a template for one of them with an X where every piece of data is. You know, copy it with a block copy command as much as you need to. And then for each field, you do control F to where the X is, and you press the delete key once, and then type your thing.
Oh, so macro. It was a macro.
Well, it was a kludge from a program that was supposed to do something entirely different.
Right.
Whether he bought it and used it, I don't know. But that's what I remember doing. It was an obvious market for a special purpose piece of software if there wasn't a general purpose template-driven editor.
Yeah.
You know, to be able to sort of type in an easygoing way and come out with an exact format somebody wanted to see movie scripts in.
Right.
You know, so you can eliminate a specialized secretary to type them up that way, or make her own a lot more productive.
And
another time, somebody at a computer store sold a real estate agent a system for searching his listings.
Mm-hmm.
This consisted of typing them all into WordMaster, the text editor, And if you use WordStar much for large files, you'll remember if you tried to back up very far, it went very slowly.
Yeah.
Because you would have to schlep all the text through from one temporary file to the other, and then back as you went forward again. And he said, suddenly I put in more listings and my thing slowed down. And I asked him what he was doing, and I was amazed that he was even trying to do that. You know, you're supposed to have a database program to do that. Only DBase 2 wasn't out yet.
So he was trying to use it as a MLS, a multiple
listing. Yeah, I told him to buy some more memory, and he did, and it worked. For a while.
For a while.
You know, they let him get a bit of the edge in the market by automating something that there wasn't yet handy software out there to automate.
Right. Wow. So with no sales force, how on earth did you guys get visibility? What carried the market for you guys?
Look through your bike archive.
Okay.
Same word wrote. Thing about this big explaining the program, and he printed the rest of the page in a real bright purple, especially picked out. And I think it's a description of WordMaster or a description of SuperSort.
Mm-hmm.
And dealers would call up and say, we want a sample. And he said, sorry, it's full retail. And they'd say, well, we're going to resell it. Do we get a discount? If you want the discount, you have to order five at once.
Oh.
And people would do that shit, which lets you start a company with no capital.
Oh.
I mean, okay. It didn't stay that way. A couple of years later, you had to offer credit and free samples.
Right.
But at that time, there was beginning to be some way to credit who was really a dealer or not. So you didn't just get random Joes. You know, because we didn't know anybody from nothing.
Right.
The business they were in or anything. Or anything. It was, yes, we'll give you a discount if you buy the five copies at a time. If you want one to evaluate, send us $4.95. And yeah, we'll give you the discount retroactively when you order four more.
Wow.
But we'll run your check through before we ship it, too.
Right.
But
so were you guys, you were operating out of a house or an old office, or did you have a warehouse eventually?
Let's see, what was the very first office? Seymour rented some space from a friend.
It was in East Bay, right? MicroPro?
No, it was in North Bay.
North Bay.
In, Rohnert Park. But I didn't work there a hell of a lot. I worked at home.
Yeah.
My two-bedroom apartment, one bedroom, which was full of computers.
You never did you modem in, or that you guys?
No, I didn't have a modem then.
Not at that time. No.
Modems till into the '80s.
Yeah. Oh, you had real slow ones in the '70s. Acoustic coupler.
Oh yeah. No, I never really.
Oh, you would drive there faster.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, my friend Arturo made a CPM computer that worked if you dialed into it. This is something I didn't find out about till years later.
Mm-hmm.
The man I met in San Francisco. There was something it did, or that you had to put in your software until the computer was alive.
Hmm.
So one shot had to get goosed every so many seconds.
Hmm.
And if it didn't, the system reset and rebooted.
Hmm.
And that let you, we made it practical to use the CPM computer dialing in without somebody there.
Right. You know, right.
With something, of course, you didn't want to change diskettes.
Right.
You know, if you're working one small enough so all the stuff, everybody you might dial in could stay in your two or whatever number of drives.
So when WordMaster was selling RHEL, how did WordStar grow out of WordMaster?
Well, WordMaster was the line reading text editor.
Right.
And, you know, it didn't sell well. There weren't all that much sales until we were showing WordStar.
Right.
You know, and suddenly a dealer would look at that and say, ah, this is what makes a computer system sellable. It will suddenly work for people. You know, it was a $495 thing that would complete a sale of several thousand dollars.
Wow. So would you demo...
lots of those sold.
Would you demo... What machine would you be on, and what printer would you be having usually when you were doing those demos?
I don't remember demoing a printer. But I think by the time we were selling WordStar, we had salespeople to do that. And they had programming goals they wanted me to achieve. And I usually said, yeah, I'd love to travel when there's nothing to do, but if you want this thing out, I'm going to stay here and work on it.
Okay.
If you want this thing not too many days late, I'm not going to... and I appreciate the offer to go to Japan, but I need to stay home and code if you want your sales.
So would you run on MSI or would you run on other CPM machines? I mean, MSI was kind of gone by then or was on the way out.
Yeah, I stayed running on MSI. But
they would have had all kinds of Kremenkos and different machines.
Probably, I don't remember an awful lot, largely because we were largely MSI people.
Right.
We had a hardware hacker who had been customer service at MSI, or he would fix things at MSI. And eventually they had both the chief engineer and the, was I guess the Bruce Fanatic, I guess, was in charge of the programmers before I became chief programmer. He's the guy that hired me at MSI.
So that would be...
He worked with Seymour for a while.
So that would have been... So Seymour at MicroPro.
Yeah, and we had a sales guy who came from MSI.
So you're rolling in through 79, 1980. Mm-hmm. And from my understanding, IBM went... calling on everybody's doorsteps to look for stuff for their IBM PC project in Florida in Boca Raton, and they wanted to ship something in a year, and they were in the spring of 80, it must have been, they were going over to see Gary Caldwell and couldn't see him and whatnot.
That sounds right. And
did they come,
saw Bill Gates and EJ, and he jumped at the opportunity and made the sale and then went ahead.
Did they come knocking on MicroPro's door?
Not that I'm aware of.
For applications, is later on, I mean, you guys were, it was...
Yeah, I think we went after, saw the market and went after it, but I'm...
After the launch, probably in August of 81, when, because it was a major, WordStar by that time was a major seller, presumably 81, by 81?
Yeah.
So presumably IBM would have wanted it out on the IBM PC when it came out, but
I don't think it was initially.
Yeah.
It wasn't sold under the IBM name. It was older on the MicroPro name.
They had a bunch of third-party vendors that came out that same day. I remember that day.
Oh.
It was... Anyway, there was a bunch of software company, Peachtree, or... They had a... I think that they had a wish list in Boca Raton. Well, we need to have at least a couple of each of these to launch mm-hmm. the machine with.
Mm-hmm.
And then they managed... John Draper, I think, Captain Crunch... wrote Easy Rider. Do you remember Easy Rider?
Easy Rider. There was a PC Rider, I think it was called.
And I think it became... Well, he wrote it when he was in prison.
Easy Rider.
Easy Rider.
Okay.
He's another guy who's written a word processing
yeah.
system.
I never had him particularly connected. I think of him as a phone hacker that I'd lost track of.
Yeah, and
never
he...
Never particularly connected.
He went on to do all pieces. Kinds of odd things. He's still doing odd things. he's an odd guy, but... Yeah, there's sort of a fraternal order of people who've written word processing systems who don't know each other.
There's a vacuum to fill there.
Yeah.
But,
they're all guys with beards, with white beards.
You got white beards now, yes.
And me having written a GUI with my beard is gradually getting a little white.
Yeah. Well, the other piece, of course, of my being successful in that was I'd grown up with small computers. You know, it was well into the IBM PC before you reached the crossover where the amount of functionality you could put in the program was limited by the complexity of what you could debug rather than the complexity of what you could cram into the available memory.
Right.
You know, the PDP-1, the whole game of getting a lot of functionality was what you could cram into 4K words.
Yes.
And it, I mean, I never got near the complexity of what I could debug a program get in 4K.
Mm-hmm.
It's just getting too horrendous to manage or for one person to work on. I mean, that happens at 400K.
Right.
I mean, it happens maybe at 400K in assembler and at 800K in C or something. But, you know, the name of the game wasn't just function, but how few bytes you could cram a function into. And I was good at that, because I've done almost all of my programming career in assembly on small machines.
And, of course, that's a lost art today.
Yeah.
Although...
Well, it must turn up in microcode. Can't turn it up.
Turn, yes.
Who can make the microwave oven that requires the fewest bytes of ROM?
And it turns up in AJAX, which stands for Asynchronous JavaScript XML. When people are writing everything now on the web is these small scripts and JavaScript with XML coming in and out. And those are actually compact kinds of code again, because back to interpreted code in a relatively small virtual machine, really.
Yeah, you want to be able to download them quickly.
Download it quickly, and it has to run pretty quickly. And it has to run. So you're kind of back full cycle because of bloated operating systems.
Yeah, except it's another generation of people relearning the thing.
Yeah.
Well, there's one thing I have to give Diane Hasichek for.
Diane?
Hasichek, the woman programmer I hired at
Insight. Sure, if you hired at Insight.
Yeah, she figured out how to make to cut one byte out of a message printing routine by letting it execute the message.
Hmm.
And then she chose the text of all her messages so that it was harmless when he executed it.
Oh.
And she got a byte out of her DOS.
She got a byte out of DOS.
Yeah, it was like you have a call to the machine, to the routine that prints the message, mm-hmm. and then the text immediately follows.
Mm-hmm.
If you eliminate the instruction that puts the text pointer back into the program counter
mm-hmm.
before you return,
mm-hmm.
then it or back into the stack where the program counter will come from, then it returns control to the beginning of the message instead of the end. And if you choose your letters carefully, they're harmless. And that had never occurred to me. But she went through all the messages in this particular piece of software.
That was optimization.
And it was a dangerous kind of optimization because somebody else could come along and put the wrong message in, the wrong character in, or be using the register that it destroyed that you normally weren't using.
Mm-hmm.
It saved a byte.
In the mid to late 80s, when I was writing my font and graphics editor software with Xerox, it would be Elixir stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Each release of my applications were smaller.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to squeeze, to combine functions and get rid of extraneous stuff and get it tighter and tighter, and yet it ran faster and was more reliable. So I was always...
You must not have been adding a hell of a lot.
I was adding features, but I was building more and more efficient libraries and, just...
Better factoring the functionality.
Better factoring functionality. An
incredible amount of time in that.
Yeah, and it ran better and better, and so the machines, in the end, I had to compete. There were companies that had hardware, either were dedicated mini computers that were mm-hmm. doing raster ops in bitlets in hardware,
mm-hmm.
or there were companies that had all these large custom boards that would do like rotate bitmaps and
mm-hmm.
scale stuff and whatever.
And you were trying to compete.
I did it all in software. So I wrote, and it was interesting for me because I spent all this effort writing these routines to do all this stuff in software, image processing, font processing, all that stuff. Conversions, rotations, everything. And we were at this show, and my counterpart at the competing company that was using these boards, and these boards would only run in original IBM ATs. You couldn't actually put them in anything else. They were incompatible.
Mm-hmm.
So they were, when you bought their system, you had to pretty much buy a computer as well. Couldn't just put it in. He came over to our booth, and I showed him my font editor and the glyphs rotating 90 degrees and all these special effects. And he said, what hardware board are you using?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I'm Solin software. Because he saw that it was running on all these different machines, including this plasma laptop, Toshiba laptop. He was wondering, what hardware are you using that's running in all these? I said, no, there's no hardware. And I saw his eyes get wider, and he realized mm-hmm. he's seeing his doom. He just saw. Mm-hmm.
That's where Silicon Graphics went, isn't it?
Yeah, all of them. All of them.
It's gone as the general purpose hardware gets faster.
Yeah, and we knew that, but it was a risk because it was a heck of a lot of work to get. They took the easy way out, and then they bought all this. They bought obsolescence, but it gave them about an 8-month market edge, and it killed them. One of the things that killed them was having to have that hardware. So we were running around the country demoing on Toshiba laptops of 1988 circa. You could run the software anywhere,
mm-hmm.
and you could send a floppy and to trial versions, and they were stuck with having to cart these machines around. Yeah,
now we do a Windows system call and you don't know what happens.
Yeah.
Except I do know if you change your video board, your displays can speed up a whole lot in Windows.
Oh, okay.
because different video boards have more hardware.
Yeah.
So more hardware that helps.
When did you leave the fold of the WordStar world? What was?
I should find a date to put on that. I think it's 81-ish.
So around the
Well, I didn't do it for a long time.
Right, right.
Yeah, I did not participate in porting it to the IBM.
To the IBM.
Yeah, but I bought a version. But, so they might pay full retail for it.
They probably, by the end of 81, they were probably doing the port. And after that, what was your landing spot when you went on?
Let's see. I did that. I did some Windows applications. I had worked with my brother and his company, and they wound that company up, but he was working for an energy company. You know, he was into solar energy and then energy in general. But what he was doing in solar energy was simulating, or one of the big things was simulating heating and cooling houses, and computing how the sun went through the windows and all kinds of stuff.
Sure, yeah.
Remember, early in that work, they had a professor involved in the company. He had time between 1 a.m. and 2 a.m. on some big CVC machine at Cal Berkeley, I remember. And he'd go in the middle of the night and be running these big card programs. Because, of course, it's something that's very compute intensive.
Yeah.
I mean, you have a computation that you perform at least hourly for a year to simulate the energy, annual energy consumption of a house. Mm-hmm. Then you fiddle with the design a little bit and see if it saves money by running the same typical year again. Mm-hmm. And you know, now that's pretty fast, but that was tens of minutes.
Yeah.
Tens of minutes went on CPM machines when they first came out. See, he did a transition. He had, remember the book, the Soul of a New Machine?
Yes, Tracy Kidder.
Yes, my brother's company had serial number 5 of that machine.
It was about Data General, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it was the Data General Eclipse.
The Eclipse, right.
And a big Eclipse. They had the 5th one made.
Hmm.
I mean, here he is, a graduate student, another graduate student, and they went and talked to DEC, and they laughed at them. They went and talked to Data General, and Data General took them seriously, so they bought a Data General computer. I mean, the DEC salesman didn't think these people were serious customers.
Mm-hmm.
And they ended up buying... Let's see, that was a little further down the road, though, I think. They had a Data General mini computer, and then when the one the book was written about came out, they bought the 5th one.
Wow.
But they were already at a Data General company, and that already had...
already done.
Yeah, one thing they certainly discovered, I guess a lot of people discovered, is you buy this computer, they think you do your computing, and you get a time-sharing operating system. And you put terminals in everybody's desk. Mm-hmm. Suddenly people discover all sorts of things they never thought they'd do in the computer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they do all their text editing on it, all their documents and stuff, and you need a bigger computer than you thought. That's right. One of his funny things were they were running Data General's best operating system,
mm-hmm.
AOS, Advanced Operating System, on a smaller configuration than most other customers use. It was even a smaller configuration than they tested it on, so they often found small memory bugs. But it worked well enough for them, it's just as though they upgraded the machine.
So that would have been what, the late?
Bigger one.
The mid to late 80s, right? With your brother's company?
Eclipse? They had the... I'm trying to place the new machine. They had the original Eclipse between MSI and WordStar.
Mm-hmm.
When I was working for them, I'd go over there and work on Fortran programs and stuff for him. And little pieces for his grant schemes. Then when I got back into it, they moved it all to PCs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was when we'd go home for Christmas in Massachusetts and we'd lug a Compaq 286.
Yeah.
Sometimes it took some convincing to tell the stewardess that this really will go under the seat in a 757.
Right.
And no, it won't go under next to the window, but the three of us will put it in the middle one is big enough.
In the ad for the Osborne one, it shows a guy trying to put the Osborne under the seat, and you look at that and said, there's no way that thing's going under the seat. But the ad shows, the print ad for the Osborne showed a guy.
Well, the compact's just about as big, I think.
Yeah, it was just about as big.
Maybe it's not quite as deep.
Yeah.
But,
maybe the planes got bigger temporarily, now they're smaller. But the seats are smaller.
Changed the, yeah, they've changed the seat width. They keep advertising more leg room. Damn it, I want more shoulder bone.
Right.
You know, put five seats across the 757, not six. Until you're going to do that, don't bother me.
Right.
But, then I tend to fly at holidays a lot, so it was, because the 757 is fairly spacious if the middle seat is empty.
Yeah.
Then you've got room to stick your elbows out. But it never is around Christmas.
So you're
anyway,
you're
yeah, so I worked a bunch. He had this humongous program that would do a bunch of things, helping with the energy design, but it would do a bunch of the graphics also.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could draw this building plan in, and then you could just, give me a perspective view from the direction the sun is looking at a certain hour, and it would draw that for you. And it never quite got commercial. It was ahead of the hardware. I mean, by the time it would have got commercial, you could found somebody to pay him a salary to do other stuff.
And you said earlier your last programming was under Windows 3.1?
Yeah, he went and worked for this company that had an idea for basically a much simpler program to do energy lights, you know, to walk through a building and look at your light bulbs and stuff. And, it was particularly effective for lighting, you know, because you can look at a light fixture and say you can replace this with that. And your lumens are only 5% less, or they're 5% more, and mm-hmm. your electricity is 40% less.
Yeah.
You know, it pays off in 3.3 years. Do it.
Right, right.
But whereas a lot of the other stuff was much vaguer, they had to make a lot more assumptions.
So you wrote the code for that, to do the numbers?
Yeah, he and I did a bunch of the, and a bunch of the interfacing, a bunch of how you input the data and stuff, because we built a library on top of Windows 3.1. A library for doing dialog boxes.
Yeah.
And that, again, another great thing that never went anywhere.
I remember Borland's toolkit was always better than Microsoft's for doing the dialog boxes.
Yeah.
At least it was open.
But neither was available when we were trying to do this.
Okay.
But, yeah, the last I knew, the people he's working for now are doing it all through Microsoft Foundation Glasses.
Yeah, they pretty much took over.
Well, we did. Yeah, we had a library we got from somebody, and I kept finding I had to drop back into Windows code to get it to exactly what I wanted because the library didn't quite come out right. And by the time I'd handled all the fiddles, I might as well have just coded it in Windows.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we wrote a sort of interpretive thing to help do that and to shorten the code a lot. Because we came up with a lot less code to do the same job than MFC uses.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because they give you a lot of nice stuff, but it duplicates the code for each dialog box.
So now you're
I'm pretty well out of touch with it.
Yeah, now you're living like me here, country living.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look back, sometimes the question I ask people in these interviews this will go on the website. I just put I put a Creative Commons license on everything, which means anybody can use it for non-commercial use. Like mm-hmm. research and stuff. But I always ask people, I asked this of Bob Frankston recently, because, you know, Bob Frankston we know from VisiCalc. But when you talk to him, he's like you. He started in the mid-60s and did all these different things.
I mean, VisiCalc was what made Apple II sell.
That's right. That's right. And Bob was all based in Massachusetts. He's still out of Massachusetts.
Yeah, he's done at MIT.
Yeah, he's done at MIT. He lives in... I can't remember. He lives somewhere near Boston. But I asked him, you know, if you look back on a multiverse career in computing, what was the more interesting times, you know, what would be the most interesting times that you felt for the industry as a whole and then for you within that time? Were you having the most fun, or it seemed like there were new frontiers to be conquered?
Mm. Well, there's always the trade-off between what's interesting to work on and what lots of people want. Because WordStar was really pretty simple. I mean, if you write WordStar in C, it'd be a short, simple program.
Yeah.
C++. But zillions of people wanted it. It made a big difference in the world. The energy stuff, particularly Takeoff, the program that never quite came together, was a bit of push. Some parts of it, they were a little too ambitious. Those were programming it. I mean, we had lots of funny things where you couldn't quite tell whether one wall joined another. And we didn't want to make the user specify that.
Mm-hmm.
This made the user interface too complex, and the programmer to make it come out.
Right.
Yeah. In a lot of cases, you know, didn't quite work because your round off error got bigger than your tolerance for considering things matching.
So it was more of a specialist's environment.
That was a more interesting intense thing. But then this energy application, particularly the lighting part of it, you know, was really complete and effectively done and did its job well. It made sense. And the company had management issues, and they were all over it. They were all over the place in energy without being particularly focused on anything for a while, and then they gave up all their computer stuff.
Right, and went back just to pure, rather than selling a computer product or software product, they were just selling systems, right? Energy systems.
Well, at one point they were trading natural gas.
Oh, okay.
Buying and selling
the paper.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, we have a oil price crisis. Oh, energy's going to be a big thing. Let's get some venture capital and start a company devoted to that, and then figure out later how to actually make money at it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, most of the people who do that don't make money. But
early
they had some grand programming thing. Before my brother was involved, or they hired a whole bunch of consultants who were trying to write beautifully, properly nested class sets in C++, and they spent hundreds of thousands of dollars and didn't produce anything useful.
Hmm.
I mean, somebody had to say, wait a minute, we spent only so much on tools, and then we make some demonstrable results.
When you were put your hands on the PDP-1 way back,
mm-hmm.
what did you... I mean, that was a totally different experience, a different machine, different culture.
Yeah, you didn't put your hands on it.
You didn't put your hands on it. You sort of...
No. Because this was tangier at PDP-1. You put your hands in your teletype.
Okay.
And you could work on it all day and all night. Except for the hour a day when they shut it down to dump the drum. Copy the drum to mag tape. They couldn't do that.
And that was that time-shared one in the mid-60s, time-shared PDP-1.
Yeah.
That's such an... interesting idea of a time-shared PDP-1.
Yeah, well, it was a big PDP-1. It was called a PDP-1D. It had four instructions in it that weren't in a normal one.
Okay.
One of which is transferred to such and such an address and such a memory bank. Because the machine addressed 4K. Yeah.
Right.
The instruction set. But the machine had six 4K memory banks in it. You know, two of them ran the two users that were now running. It didn't have read-only code like a modern machine would have. Every user had a copy of the program if they were running the same one.
Yeah.
And then the rest were full of system stuff.
Wow.
But there was and it trapped illegal instructions and I/O instructions. You know, they would either be ignore or halt a person or a single user computer. You know, they all trapped and went to the operating system. So they were used for system calls, and if you weren't a valid system call, they terminated your process.
And sitting down there running the link, you know, for me it seems, oh, this is normal. This is running like running a command prompt CPM system or whatever. And then you think, wait a minute, you know, this is 15 years before,
mm-hmm.
and the link experience was radical. It was a radical departure because it was devoted to one user, wasn't time shared. You turned it off at night. You loaded your own code on your own tapes. It was very responsive to the screen, but there was no other...
Did you do assembly language stuff on it?
And you did assembly language stuff on
your
it.
Your code?
Yeah.
Under the impression they did, you said they did basic and APL.
Oh, not on the
really
link.
Not on the
link.
Oh, that was the 5100.
That's the 5100, yeah.
Okay.
So on the link, it had its own assembler and its own screen editor. So sitting there, it was interesting,
mm-hmm.
sitting there running programs, watching graphics happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep having to knock my head and say, this is the early 60s.
Yeah, see, I never edited on a CRT till an ADM3.
Yeah, and this is editing on a
Left over
CRT.
from that damn site.
And I think it did do the word wrap and everything. It's all in the documentations. And in fact, here's an interesting thing. There were you could attach printers to the link. They're chain impact printers or whatever, but there's four screws on either side of this 5-inch CRT, and there's a hood that you can get, and you can mount a camera, an SLR camera, and you took pictures of the screen for graphics to then put on a Polaroid and put in your paper. So that was the method by which they were publishing their curves.
The printers were text.
The printers were
graphics
text.
On it made really crummy graphics.
That's right, and so you got relatively good plots and things right off the screen as a raster, because it was a 256 by 256 raster. And so the thing was kind of like a regular machine. And this is why when Alan Kay wrote, because we wrote him and invited him to this event, he couldn't come, but he wrote a little summary saying that the Link is, in my opinion, the first personal computer. And so that modality, there was a guy who programmed this, I think it was 1963 or 4, he was programming on the Link, and he would program all night, and he would be on this thrill thing. And I said, you know, you were one of the first people who kind of had the thrill of coding on a machine. It was dedicated to you, and it was very responsive, screen editing. Mm-hmm. And of course you looked up and it was dawn. Mm-hmm. And you were one of the pioneers, and he sort of thought, yeah, that's probably right. I mean,
of course, the other advantage of a time-shared machine was it ran much faster in the middle of the night.
Yes.
Because there are a fair number of users that worked during business hours.
That's right, and the Link didn't run faster or slower.
Yeah, and there was sort of this illusion that CPU didn't matter. You know, the CPU ought to be able to keep up with an indefinite number of 10 character per second teletypes.
Yeah.
Which is definitely not true. You know, because it's also keeping up with the fact that you're frequently recompiling as you're developing a program.
Yeah,
you know, you need to read the whole thing from a drum and write the binary back. Every little change you make.
And IBM had those page mode 3270 screens, which you were talking to the controller in between, and then you were hitting a submit and sending an entire page. So it wasn't seeing individual characters. That was going to a controller controlling lots of CRTs.
Yeah, but I never used one of those.
Yeah, and that was a weird experience.
The ones I used, every time you pressed a key, it interrupted.
And that was Dec's idea was that there shouldn't be a controller. It added cost and complexity. But that's why IBM was used for the Sabre system, because you could scale it to 10,000 terminals.
Jesus.
Yeah, okay. So the Sabre, the people are filling out the thing, and they're not talking to the CPU.
See, to me, one of the things that makes a difference in how many terminals you can handle, if the timeshare system would have a system call that got you a single keystroke, and it would have another system call that buffered a line. It did a few editing characters in the system, and if you got an editor or a control character, then it came to your program. That would handle a lot more terminals if the program had to go out of core.
Yeah.
You know, if it was coming in every keystroke,
and
you're using a lot of the swapping capacity of the machine.
I asked Wes Clark, I said, why is it that, you know, here at the Link project, I'm keep going back to that, they said that no one thought the Link mattered because the big thing then was inventing time sharing. And that whole thing was about that fascination with how do you create a computing resource you can share.
Well, there's the theory then that the power of a CPU went with the square of the price.
Right. Right.
And the microprocessor seemed to have eliminated that.
Yeah. So that Butler Lamson wrote
some of the more powerful ones you can get are cheap enough.
In the 70s, Butler Lamson or somebody at Park said, you know, today it was like 1974 or something. Today, we've gone down below 1 cent a bit, and that would have been a bit for CRT display or whatever, and that by 1980, it will be affordable to do a raster workstation, like a full-power workstation with a GUI and everything. And they were watching this curve of memory go down, and they realized, you know, we're not going to be commercial till then, but we're going to get there.